Hi, this is Tristan Gauthier, and you need more front wings.
Hello and welcome to another More Front Wing podcast. A little bit less informal this time, perhaps, than the last one. As much fun as it was, I'm Steph Wallcraft here with my co-editor Paul Dalby, and we've decided that we have enough to talk about since the last time we spoke with you all, that we're just going to dig right in and tackle it all on our own. We've got a very long list of topics to cover since the last time we spoke to you, which was on the Friday night of the Toronto race weekend. Gosh, an awful lot has happened. So we're going to sort of break down all of the stories that we thought were notable coming out of the Toronto weekend, with both of us having been on the ground there. And there's been some other side news for the series as well. But for example, the engine rules announcement that came out today, the release of the movie Turbo. We'll talk a little bit about what impact or not that seems to have had so far, and the NBC Sports Network deal to bring NASCAR into its race properties and sort of become speed 0.5, let's say. But anyway, we'll get to all of that later. First, let's dig right into the race weekend, the doubleheader weekend at Toronto. And gosh, there was an awful lot to talk about. You knew right from the moment that it was announced that Bo Barfield was unable to be there for personal reasons, that Brian Barnhart was going to be running the show, that it was just going to be one of those weekends.
Talk about an unfair... An unfair position to be put in. To start your first race back, or your only race back as race director, or your only event, I guess, with two races there, and have it be at Toronto, that traditionally has so much carnage and tempers flaring anyway. Yeah, like you said, there was never going he was in a bad position to start.
And it's the series' only second doubleheader weekend of all time, and it was to host the series' first ever standing start. Which already people were complaining and were concerned that the preparation for that really hadn't been quite adequate as it was. Then you had the race director, who was supposed to be in charge of it all, not showing up. So
what could go wrong?
Yeah, seriously, people were a little edgy. Let's put it that way. And of course, there were ramifications of a sort. Well, it's hard to say exactly where to start when talking about this race. So let's just go with the flow of the conversation and jump right into the topic of the penalty to Dario Franchitti, because that certainly was one of the big stories of the weekend coming out of race one. The blocking penalty, is that the terminology that they used?
Yes.
Yeah. That was 25 seconds that moved him off the podium, which he comically found out about as he was standing there getting his trophy, and was theoretically to move him down to 13th, and then was later rescinded at about 8 o'clock that night. I think you and I were still in the media center when Amy, the head of IndyCar PR, stood up and told everybody what was going on, and everybody started sort of yelling, "Rewrite!"
Yeah, we had a great position between Bruce Martin and Jenna Fryer and Patrick Steffen at TSO, and yeah, you could just see all three of their heads just kind of bow.
Oh.
Find themselves to another half hour of writing, and it had already been a long, long day.
Yes, it had, and it was just a bit crazy, but it's at least cooler heads prevailed in the end. Seems like one of those things that hopefully the record books won't remember, and it just comes down to sort of that difference in race directing style, right? I mean, this is the very thing that Brian found himself in hot water for. The entire time that he operated as race director was that kind of call. Now, where that does get touchy, though, is that Bo, earlier, you know, last year and earlier this year, had sort of been tending not to be so quick to the trigger on making those kinds of calls. But, I mean, we saw at Brazil and coming out of that the drivers were taking issue with that. And so the part of the story that we're not necessarily getting is how much of that call might have come from the drivers pushing for a little bit more regimented policing of blocking, as opposed to, you know, just maybe the difference in style as well. If Brian was privy to the drivers wanting to see more of that kind of column, and it was sort of a knee-jerk reaction to the situation, for example, in Brazil, then that would be a different situation. It's just such a shame that Brian's name was tied to it, because that immediately threw everybody up in arms as soon as the topic came up. So it, not having sat in on any of the drivers' meetings, it's really hard to say what exactly the origin of that may have been, but at least at the end, the team provided the information that got the call reversed. And it was all very well detailed that they had provided, I think, throttle information and steering data from the 10 car. And that was what finally was the point that made the decision back, which is, you know, the logical response in the end. So it's a shame that all the rigmarole had to be gone through to begin with, but in the end, at least the result was right.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the important thing to remember, is that they ended up getting the call right. And whether it happens, you know, right away or it took 2 hours to get it, at least I give them credit for going back, for reviewing the data, taking a good, honest look at it, being open to the challenge from the Target Chip Ganassi team, bringing in as much information as they can, and then making the call that I think most people felt was right. And ultimately, they got it right, I think. I thought it was a bad call in the first place, but I thought it was great that they took the time to reevaluate it.
There was only one person that I saw defend the call from where we were sitting anyway, and that was my editor at Toronto Star Wheels, Norris McDonald, who's been around for a little while. And his immediate reaction was, yes, that's a good call. That's the Jeff Krosnoff rule. That's the way he put it. Particularly in Toronto, people are very sensitive to not making any sudden moves on that back straight because of that unfortunate accident in 1996, was it?
Yes.
Yeah.
But here's the question, though, I have. If IndyCar had never announced that Brian Barnhart was leading race control this weekend, how much of this would have just blown over?
It's a good question.
How much of this was just a witch hunt to go after Brian because he was there?
You have to wonder. Definitely. But at the same time, I think, you know, this is a little bold of me to say, but I think the nature of the calls that were being made might have led people to come to the realization that it was Brian in charge. As I said, these are all the sorts of things that came up during his tenure regularly enough. And whoever was in charge would have been called out to defend that call regardless.
Probably so.
Yeah.
But in whether it's blocking or not, I guess I just see the drivers know who's officiating that race, and they understand that Brian traditionally has had a tighter or shorter leash on blocking.
That's a bullcrap excuse. I'm sorry. If the rules have been written properly, it shouldn't matter who's sitting in the booth. It shouldn't be that subjective.
It shouldn't, but it's still a subjective call. And no matter what sport you're looking at, you have subjective calls when you have human elements officiating it. Whether you're talking baseball, basketball, football, or racing, something that subtle. This isn't like he ran over an air hose in the pits, or they had eight guys over the wall, or, you know, they had an illegal fuel tank. Something easily mm-hmm. seen and defined. No. This was such a subtle move.
If it was that subtle of a move, then it shouldn't have been a call to begin with. If it's not clearly demonstrable, and it wasn't in this case, that a rule has been violated, that they've been very clear on what's been allowed all year, and everybody who looked at it afterwards said that was allowed based on what we've been told, then there shouldn't have been a call in the first place. I don't buy that for a second, no.
I agree that, no, there shouldn't have been a call, but whatever they saw enough of that it was Brian Barnhart and Ari Leyendyk and Bill Van de Zandt and Derek Walker agreed. I mean, there some majority of that group in race control agreed enough with what they saw initially to make that call. And again, like you had said, we don't know what was said in the driver's meeting. We thought that coming out of Brazil...
A pretty good idea of what was said in the Sunday driver's meeting.
Well, we're not talking about Sunday quite
no.
yet.
No.
But we knew, coming out of Brazil and going into Indianapolis, Is that the right order? Yeah.
Yeah.
Brazil into Indianapolis. There was a lot of talk about the blocking rule, particularly in light of what Takuma Sato had done to Newgarden and Hinchcliffe.
Yeah. Newgarden and then Hinch later.
Right.
But Hinch got around it.
Right. Eventually did. But there was a lot of talk, and it was very clear. Now, since then, and I think it was it Patrick Steffen we were talking to, and he had said that there had been some much more, I don't want to say formal, but certainly agreed upon alterations to the rules since Indianapolis or since that Brazil incident. Mm-hmm. So what those were, we're not privy to what those were. We're not privy to what was said in the drivers' meeting before Toronto as to what was allowed, what wasn't allowed. So whatever it was that wasn't allowed, the men in race control obviously saw something that they didn't like initially. And it may have been just because they only had one somewhat questionable view of it. But I like the fact that they made the call and they made it right away and then went back to fix it.
It seems as though a lot of the basis of it was following the guidelines on that were painted, that are naturally painted on the road.
Right.
And that's what everybody that was around us that was analyzing it was looking at was, oh, his wheels crossed the line and then crossed back.
Right.
But what now, that doesn't take into account is that there's a natural bend.
Right.
In the road there, and that's also the point in the straightaway where they're setting up for three.
Exactly. Now, see, that's where I argue the other side of the coin is because those lame stripes are, you know, fixed width, probably 12 foot or whatever that is in Canada, 3 meters, 4 meters, something like that.
I can tell you, I'm not a pavement engineer.
Well, I'm just telling you, they're usually 12 foot lanes.
Are you supposed to know?
Well, yeah, in the U.S., they would be 12 to 12 and a half foot lane widths.
Right.
So call it 4 meters.
You don't have to call it anything meters. We understand feet.
But those are fixed width for driving your cars. As you said, that's not a natural racing line.
No.
And where they kept talking about him crossing that line is right where, you don't want to call it an apex, but more of a kink in Lakeshore Boulevard there, right under the bridge. So, yeah, to say he crossed that line and use that as justification for a block, I had a hard time with that. I expressed that right away. But I still think if there was a question that he had blocked, I think they made the right call to put the penalty on right away and then go back and look. I think you would have had a much bigger problem if you would have let it go and then go back and look at it 2 hours later and announce, oh, by the way, we're giving Franchitti a 25-second penalty and dropping him 10 positions. I think it's much easier to take it away, take the penalty away, rescind that penalty hours later than it is to impose the penalty. Yes or no?
No, I don't like the optics of making a safety call with the option of removing it later. When it's that subtle, I'd rather just let it go.
Again, though, it seems subtle to us, but we don't know what was said. What was subtle to us,
it's that subtle that they're going to have a hard time explaining to fans exactly what the problem was, then it's too subtle.
But if a majority of the people in race control agreed and made the call,
we don't know exactly what went on in race control.
We don't. We don't.
No one does, except for the three men who were in there.
Okay, yeah, I'll give you that. We don't know exactly what happened, but, you know, jumping ahead a little bit and getting ahead of the conversation, most of the people that watching didn't understand the tire rule that was going to come into effect the next day. Just because people don't understand the rule and it isn't necessarily explicitly stated to the fans and the public, or in that case even the media, doesn't mean that you don't still have to abide by those rules.
I know. We're spending a lot of time going around in circles here. Ultimately, it came right. And I think that by the time it had come right, everybody agreed that the right thing had been done. If there is something that was addressed by making the initial call that people on the outside don't understand, somebody should take the time to explain it, I would think, because it's going to come up again. And if it was just a difference in calling style between Brian and Bo, then so be it. Probably isn't going to come up again. So I think we've now spent an awful long time just to say, yeah, we think that ultimately justice was done, and let's hope that it doesn't come up again. And please, if there has been some major, major change to the way that blocking is going to be policed, then let people know, because that is the sort of thing that the people watching at home, of all the things that people watch when they're watching racing, that is the one thing that I think people relate to the most easily, is the rules and how the rules are applied and enforced. So I think that's pretty important to let people know how exactly that works. And I don't think that's been effectively done, if in fact there has been some major change that made that move by Dario on the back straight at Toronto so close to a penalty that this whole issue came up. That's my opinion.
Okay. I'll let you have the last word there.
Thanks. Let's move on to the standing start. We don't really need to spend a lot of time on this either, because certainly it's been, you know, analyzed and beaten up and down and sideways. But I think you and I both agree that they were far, far too quick to throw the initial attempt. I think it was good that they decided to do it again for race two and didn't just let it go. And my opinion was that when they did finally get it organized on race two, and I like the fact that in the drivers' meeting the next morning, on Sunday morning, they told the drivers basically, we are going to keep doing this until we get it right. So don't you be trying anything. And then they did get it right. And I don't know what you thought, because we never actually did get a chance to talk about this, but I thought it was awesome. And I really enjoy it. A lot of people think that the standing start doesn't belong in IndyCar because it's not traditional. And I'm normally a traditionalist, but I really enjoyed the standing start. I really enjoy the variety. I really enjoy that it requires the drivers who are going to participate in this series to have one extra skill set on top of everything else that they need to be able to do to be successful in this series.
Yeah, I'll grant you that. To be, you know, I watched the start of that race from turn five, and quite honestly, by the time they got there on the first lap, I couldn't tell the difference whether they were a standing start and rolling start. So really, you're only talking about affecting the first, you know, couple hundred yards of the race, unless, of course, like you say, or at least intimated there, if somebody has a problem off the start, which we did see that with Dario in the second race, where he had rear-ended Elio, I think, in the first corner, ended up having to come in for a new wing.
But that that happens in stand or rolling starts too.
Exactly. I was going to say, I don't think we can blame that solely on the standing start. But yeah, it is. It's just another element that the drivers have to be able to perform. So it adds another bit of variety to the series. So I don't know. I could take it or leave it. It wouldn't break my heart if they had standing starts at some events. If they did away with them, I wouldn't really care then either.
Well, they've almost gotten into territory now where they kind of can't do away with it because it would make them look foolish. And yet, a lot of the buzz over the weekend was how the engines weren't really designed to handle it, and there hadn't been much time spent by the teams on practicing for it, and but I think now that it's been done, and now that the work has been done to ensure that it can be done, they kind of have to keep doing it. And I would like to see it at more events. I wouldn't mind seeing it at just about every road and street course event, really.
I don't know if you need it that often.
Well, I don't see a reason. Like, how do you decide where it gets done and where it doesn't?
I don't know. But why the need? Why do you have to... Why do you have to go to standing starts? Why do you need to completely change that when the rolling starts aren't working poorly in some places?
I don't know. I guess that's not up to us to decide. Somebody within IndyCar has to decide which markets are going to want it and where it's going to be successful and where it's not, I guess.
I mean, maybe they only do it at doubleheader weekends.
We're going to talk about this later, but who knows whether we're even going to have doubleheaders again after this year. Certainly the drivers and the teams would prefer that we didn't, so. But we'll get into that later.
Unless your name is Scott Dixon, I guess.
Right, well, you can be successful at them without wanting them.
True.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about Scott Dixon now. That's a logical place to go from there. Actually pulls off getting the Sonics Perfect Finish Award. I did not see that coming. I really did not think that anybody would claim that this year, but there he goes. He's gone and done it. And he's what, three races in a row now that he's won. All of a sudden, he's second to Elio in the championship, and we're going to Mid-Ohio. And, like, we haven't even shown up at Mid-Ohio yet, and he's going to win that race. I'm not even going to bother asking you to pick somebody because he's going to win that race. We all know he is.
Yeah, but Elio's not bad there either. Elio runs well at Mid-Ohio, but I agree. I mean, Dixon's going to be the
favorite. He's owned that place.
The last few years, yeah.
Yeah, so.
What's he got, 4 wins, 5 wins?
So all of a sudden, here's late season form Dixie like we're so used to seeing again.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's funny because you and I noticed a few things about the Ganassi cars, didn't we, in Toronto?
We did notice.
We noticed a couple of interesting parts.
Nuances.
Yeah. Some subtle differences between the Ganassi cars and some of the other cars. And so clearly that team has been spending some time on development. And actually, I can go into a little bit more detail on them because Scott answered a question that was posed by I'm trying to find a subtle way to say it was my question without saying I asked this, but yeah, it was my question in the post.
That was subtle. Very nice. Nicely done.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to make it myself out to be great. I thought it was a really interesting response because what I asked him was, you know, we know that for the last 18 months, Ganassi has not had the success that they're used to having. And we know it's not Scott, that's the problem, because we know how talented he is. He always has been. Nothing has changed with him. And so clearly something has changed either on the engine, and we do know that Honda released a new generation of engine right before Pocono, or something has changed with the development of the car. And we also know that Ganassi did some testing at Sebring and came away apparently with these trick parts. And so I said to Scott, is there one thing or another there that you think has contributed to the success that Ganassi is having all of a sudden? And he said that he thought it was a combination of both. He thought that the next generation of Honda engine was better, and that that they had found some things at Sebring that were really working for them. So would not at all be surprised to see this success for the Ganassi team continue through the end of the season and maybe even beyond, although now we're learning that Honda is going to be developing making some changes to their engine to accommodate the twin turbo for next year. But we'll get deeper into that later in the show. But I thought that was a very interesting response from him. Still a little cagey, you know. He's not going to come out and say, yeah, we changed this, but definitely they're pretty willing to cop to the fact that they've done some stuff and that it's working. So,
you know, I think about this and I think back to last year of how they struggled at the start. Then all of a sudden they won, you know, Dario won at Indianapolis. Scott followed that up with a dominating win. I think they went 1-2 at Detroit after that last year. And then they kind of just disappeared, and Scott popped up again at Mid-Ohio, and then they ran strong at Fontana. So, you know, last year you kept seeing these glimpses, and this year this was really the first time, I think, that you've really seen Scott dominate like this. I think most people would agree that they probably weren't the strongest car at Pocono, even though they swept the podium much in a fuel mileage race. It's going to be interesting to see throughout the rest of the year, can Scott and really Dario, because he had a great weekend as well, can they really keep this momentum going? Are they actually back, or is this another one of those glimpses like we've seen before?
Well, I mean, the thing that might be working against them is that we've got through the doubleheader at Toronto, and then now we've got 3 weeks off, and there's a full-day test at Mid-Ohio on the Wednesday before the race weekend there. So it is possible that some of the teams will have, you know, taken a look at the Ganassi cars and some other things, and will have had time to regroup and do a little bit of development, not a ton, obviously, but a little bit, and come back with something to challenge them with. There's been enough time that's certainly within consideration.
You know, something I just got thinking of as well, as you were talking about how they've struggled the last year and a half. It's pretty well known that Scott and Dario drive very different styles of cars.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dario likes his with the little, I think he likes a little pushier car, and I think Scott likes a little looser car. And I just kind of wonder if that dichotomy of driving styles has really caused Target Chip Ganassi Racing to struggle to adapt to the DW12 much more so than like an Andretti Autosport, where those drivers tend to like closer cars. And they're not all the same either, but they're closer, I think. Hmm. And I think you really see that at Penske as well, where Will is known to like a very loose car as well, where Elio likes a much more neutral or pushy car. And we've seen both of those teams somewhat struggle to really come to grips to this car. Could it be because the data that they're sharing isn't necessarily compatible between the two entries on either of those teams?
It's just something
I got thinking about as you were talking about the struggles over the last 18 months, where you look at Andretti. Last year they ran three cars or four last year?
Three.
They ran three last year, and they run four this year. You know, even if you only have two of those four, you still have twice as much data that's compatible than what the Ganassi and the Penske guys have.
Hmm.
But now that we've had, 15 races? No, we have more than 15. 16 races last year, I guess, and gone through 13 this year. So, I mean, you're pushing 30 races now in this quote-unquote new car. You know, now are the bigger teams that we expected to be back on top all along, have they finally hit that level of data knowledge that they can start to really hone in on exactly what it is that each of their drivers needs? And is that why we're seeing Dixon look coming on strong, why Dario's looking strong? Will Power, even though he hasn't had the luck yet, he's looked strong. He had a strong weekend this weekend. Elio's been pretty strong really all year long.
Yeah, but Elio's had a weird year because he's been, like you said, pretty strong, but is now leading the championship.
So he's consistent.
He's finding his consistency. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, to your point.
But I mean, he's finished every lap this year as well.
Mm.
I mean, that's a good year.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just accidentally, with a mediocre year, finish every lap. You still have to have a good lap or a good season to pull off a feat like that. So, I mean, yeah, he has. What wins does he have this year?
Just one, I think.
He won at Texas, yeah.
So.
But.
You know, and, yeah, it's an interesting point. I hadn't considered that.
It'd be something I'd be interested to ask a Mike Hull or a Tim Sindrick about. See if those different driving styles on either team have contributed to their slowness or the retarded progress of moving forward as a team.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, if I ever find myself having a chat with Tim Sindrick, I'll ask him. But in the meantime...
Well, Mike Hull's a guy he's one of my favorite guys in the paddock. He's always been very good.
Maybe you can't just have a 5-minute chat with Mike Hull. That's the problem.
That's all right. I can spend 3 hours on that. Thanks.
Fair enough.
I'll make the sacrifice.
So one of the other great stories coming out of Toronto is Sebastian Bourdais and that Dragon Racing team. Sebastian doing donuts after race two because he's had two races where he's been on the podium. Because he's just that happy with that level of success. He doesn't even need a win to be over the moon. That's the intense struggle that this team has had. He revealed during the weekend that a couple of people had been released from Dragon and some changes had been made. He had his, I can't remember the name now of the lead engineer on his car.
Neil Fife?
No, that's who was released. That's
he's
moved over to Rahal Letterman Lanigan. Interestingly enough, that bit of news came out this week, and I think I didn't see which car he'll be working on. Is it? Yep.
I think he's on Graham's.
Right. Okay. And that is that's a relationship that goes back to Rahal Letterman, their win in 2008 at Watkins Glen with Ryan Hunter Ray. So. That is a return to that team, but the reason he became available was because he was released from Dragon, apparently. And I think he was on Seb's car And there were several other personnel changes at Dragon as well, apparently, and they seem to have meshed rather quickly.
The entire crew was let go, weren't they?
On the six car, not on the seven car.
Okay, I thought they did the six car a few weeks ago and the seven was this week. Okay.
I don't think so. When Seb was talking about it in the presser, he only mentioned two names on his car.
Okay.
But anyway, yes, so seems to have been a good move anyway. Right down to Sebastian being so excited that he dropped and broke his trophy.
Poor guy.
That one's going to be in the Sports Center reels for months, I think. But yeah, I mean, not much to say about it other than that it's very remarkable and it's great to see Sebastian have an opportunity to drive to his level of ability, which has not happened for many years, and definitely looking forward to see what else can come out of that team as a result of this momentum and the changes that seem to be working in their favor.
Yeah, that would be a great team or Sebastian himself would be great to see him really start to produce some results and see that car running up front consistently. Because let's be honest, that's the best looking car on the track too.
Well,
so
if livery is your motivation, then that's a different matter. But I would love to see Sebastian up at the front, to be perfectly honest with you, because he's so polarizing, and he moves the needle when he's doing well, because there are people who really are very passionate about appreciating Sebastian for his ability, and there are also people who are very passionate about greatly disliking Sebastian for his ability. So I think that having him doing well is good for the series because people actually care one way or another about how he does.
I would agree with that. Yeah, absolutely. Closest thing there is to a Paul Tracy these days, I think.
I think that's, yeah, a good comparison, given that they were once such bitter rivals. Sort of a lot of it carries through from that. So if you can't have Paul, Sebastian's the next best thing.
I'd agree.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple of other quick things before we move on from Toronto. This is one that didn't get a lot of play, but I wanted to bring it up because I thought it was interesting. We might be able to kick up a little bit of a rivalry brewing here. So that last lap incident in race two, I was on pit lane. It was about 6,000 degrees. I was watching the screen, but I hadn't really properly seen what happened. So I heard the names Ryan Hunter-Reay and Takuma Sato, and I went, oh, geez, they've dusted up again. So as I was walking back to the media center, I ran into Hinchcliffe at the Andretti Autosport pits, and I'm going to get to that conversation in a minute because that one was pretty important. But when I was done talking to Hinchcliffe, Ryan Hunter-Reay was there. So I stopped in for a second, and I asked him what had happened, and he said to me, Takuma wasn't involved in it. And I said, oh, okay, well, that's good to know. Sorry, I didn't realize because I couldn't really see. And he said, yeah, he probably deserved it, but he had nothing to do with it. And I went, ooh, yeah, that's fun. So definitely keeping an eye on that. I don't think that there's a lot of happiness in that relationship right now. Interestingly, I also did walk past Takuma as he got out of his car and spoke to his team after the incident, and it was really funny to see him demonstrate what had happened because he kind of made this motion, like his one hand went this way and then his other hand went into the first hand, and then he made like this boom motion with his hands and then he kind of shrugged.
No. I don't think your demonstration carried over very well for an audio podcast.
Perhaps not, but it was really cute to see him kind of he was doing all hand motions, and at the end of it, he was just like, I don't know. He had no idea what had happened.
He rear-ended him when he was stopped, basically.
Yeah. So
it's long and short of it.
So let's get back to that conversation with James Hinchcliffe, because that was one that actually was pretty important. He basically said out loud, and he was angry, of course, and very upset at his disappointing weekend yet again in Toronto. And he, you know, will quite readily say that he was expecting the worst coming into this race because he always has bad luck here. And lo and behold, there it was again. And then about the double headers, he basically said, nobody in this series is ever going to warm up to these. It's totally unfair that Scott Dixon now got 100 points out of this weekend, and why wasn't there a doubleheader at Ohio? Or sorry, at Iowa. That would have been great for us. And just went off about how it's very unfairly structured, and if one team has is doing well at a doubleheader event, then they get a massive advantage, and that the series really should look at tempering that to a degree. Now, we all know that the reason that the doubleheaders came into existence this year was because the contract with IZOD as the series, the title sponsor partnership with IZOD for the series required them to have a minimum of 17 events. And so that the doubleheaders were formed to create more races out of less weekends. And now there's been a lot of discussion over the fact that, you know, James Hinchcliffe perfectly expressed the concerns that the drivers and the teams and the owners have on that side. But then on the other side, and I would like to talk more about this in a minute, but just to begin to get into it, the promoters of these doubleheader events are going to fight for their lives to keep these things, because this weekend was a success in Toronto like we haven't seen in years. There were actually people there on Saturday, and they were buying concessions and drinking beer and having a great old time. And there was no question at all that attendance was way up and buzz was way up, and people were genuinely excited about it. The grandstands were packed. So how is this going to turn out? Who knows? But certainly there are very, very, very opposing opinions on the viability of these for the future, and both sides are going to be digging their heels in hard.
Yeah, Saturday's attendance, I thought, was
probably spectacular.
It was. I would almost say that the attendance Saturday this year was as good as the Sunday attendance when I was there 3 years ago. It was a solid race day attendance. It really was, and the atmosphere at the event was fantastic. It seemed like a normal Sunday event. It didn't feel like a warm up act. That I kind of felt after watching Detroit, I kind of thought that I would see Saturday more as like a warm up event. And I think I even said it to you on Saturday morning. I remember saying it didn't really feel like race day yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I forget where we were walking. It may have been out to the morning practice or the what was qualifying, I guess. We were walking out there. But by the time the race came around, it really did have that race day feel. And if it wasn't for actually having a calendar there, I would have just assumed it was like any other race day, which I wasn't expecting for whatever reason. I just wasn't expecting to have that race day feeling. But I think the atmosphere there and the crowd was into it just as much as they had been before. Maybe there was some of that excitement because of the standing start. I don't know. But I think everyone associated with the Honda Indy Toronto, you know, outside of the teams themselves, had to just be tickled pink about how wonderful this whole event really went. Like you said, concessions were being bought, tickets were bought across the board. It just seemed like a much much better supported event this year. Now, I don't know if Toronto had to pay two sanction fees. I would doubt it.
That was never released, that information.
No, not that I ever heard either. I'd be shocked if they actually had to pay two full sanction events. Maybe they paid, you know, one and a quarter, one and a half, something like that, if not just one itself. Because a lot of that sanction fee goes to, you know, basically getting the series there, paying for the IndyCar to be there. Well, you're already there. You don't need double that to go race a doubleheader. So I think there's a lot of events that are going to be trying to get doubleheaders next year. I think Detroit was satisfied with theirs. I think Toronto's definitely going to be pushing for it. Be interesting to see how it goes over in Houston. But could Long Beach maybe be in a doubleheader? Could St. Pete next year?
I don't think they'll touch Long Beach. Long Beach is doing just fine on its own. Thank you very much. I don't think anybody's going to try to mess with that formula. But the other interesting thing about this is the rumors before and during the weekend were that this would be Green Savory's last year being the promoter at Toronto, and that the strongest rumor I heard over the course of the weekend was that Andretti was interested in taking the event on, and everybody I spoke to up in the, on the Canadian end of things was saying, oh Lord, please let this happen. Because, you know, the feeling has been that Green Savory hasn't really invested as much into growing the event as they could have. But now that doubleheader's been a great success and Charlie Johnstone's been all over the media up here going, yeah, we were so happy with everything. I can't help but wonder how much of that has changed since then. And certainly I'll be looking to find a couple of those guys when I'm down in mid-Ohio in a couple of weeks to see if we can get a straight answer on that. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I would agree. I had also heard those rumors that, in fact, I had heard one step further that the Toronto event itself could be going away. I heard that on a bus from somebody who was working at one of the concessions for not an official IndyCar one, but of an IndyCar sponsor. I have a feeling that I don't think they follow the racing very well. It could very well be either A, they didn't really hear that, or B, it could have been that the promoter, as you said, the Green Savory, could be going away. It's hard to imagine, though, a promoter really wanting to walk away from it after the rebound and success that they had this year.
Well, the other thing that's working into it, things up here right now, is the politics around where different people feel that IndyCar should be racing. I mean, IndyCar has been here for 27 years racing on the streets of Exhibition Place, right? But about an hour up the road, we've got Canadian Tire Motorsport Park, which was once known as Mosport, which has made some pretty massive safety improvements over the last year, is now being run by the legendary racer Ron Fellows, who's investing a great deal into improving that facility. And there's been a little bit of whispering about whether IndyCar should and might be racing there at some point. And there's just no way that both events would be sustainable. So, but I mean, from some of the conversations I've had, my feeling is that they haven't quite changed enough at Mosport for people to think that it would be safe enough for IndyCars. That run down from the Mario Andretti Straight into, I can't recall exactly what turn number it is down there. My feeling is that it's 8. It's just very abrupt and there's not a whole lot of runoff. And my feeling is that IndyCars wouldn't be very happy with that. And so I can't help but wonder if that would be insurmountable. But certainly that's one of the things that people are talking about a lot up here. And another one is the fact that it's the laughingstock project in the Toronto area and motorsport for the last little while has been, I can't remember the exact name of it, a Canadian Motor Speedway, I think. It's a little 1 mile oval that has been in the works, has been proposed for down in the Fort Erie area for years now, and people kept saying, oh, it's never going to happen, it's never going to happen. Well, guess what? The money actually showed up, the check cleared, and it's apparently they're breaking ground at some point this year. So,
is that the Jeff Gordon one?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. It's a 1 mile oval and I think a 2.6 mile FIA approved road course, something like that. And so, of course, everybody's saying, oh, wow, there's another oval track that IndyCar could race at, or they could do a doubleheader with the road course, or look at all the possibilities. I don't know exactly what the timeline is for building that right now. I can't imagine that they would be ready before 2015 at the earliest, but that's another thing that people are sort of questioning now, is whether that would be a possibility. And again, that one, it would be too close to Toronto to sustain the downtown race and that on the IndyCar schedule, so... There's a lot going up here.
You're talking about going to Mosport, and you know you're saying it's an hour outside of Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how is that different than going to somewhere like Chicagoland Speedway? That's an hour outside from downtown Chicago.
Yeah, but nobody's trying to run a race in downtown Chicago and going to Chicagoland Speedway. That's what
I agree.
I'm saying.
All right, I agree, but I'm looking at just from the distance from your metropolitan area.
Oh no, Mosport's great. Mosport's packed. Mosport is, they do a gangbusters business. Just I was there on Sunday for the sports car race and it was packed to the gills. People camp there. People drive up for it. No, it's, I mean, Mosport's legendary. It's awesome. Everybody in Toronto loves going to Mosport. So that wouldn't be a concern. the concern is just that there's no way that this market could sustain, because remember, too, that in Toronto, our racing season is pretty short because of weather. We start in late May, early June, and we have to be done by September because it gets too cold. So I guess you could go into mid-September, but that would be the very latest. And trying to do two major IndyCar events, as well as a sports car event, and the Camping World Trucks are doing most sport this year now, and that's expected to be a long-term event. And, I mean, we've got three or four Canadian Tire Series, NASCAR Canadian Tire Series events that run in this area throughout the year. You're starting to ask a lot of motorsport dollars from people. I just don't think that IndyCar would be wise to try to add to that stress by trying to run two events. I don't think I don't think the market's there to sustain that.
I would agree, and I think Toronto is on the upswing now. The Exhibition Place event is on the upswing again. I don't think that you want to tamper with that now that you finally got that on the road to recovery. So unless there's a really, really good reason to go to Mosport, I think you're better off staying in the current street race configuration.
Well, the decision may wind up not being theirs, so we'll see what happens.
What's going on with the Exhibition Place development? There was talk a year or two ago that there could be some development on that front that could put that race at jeopardy.
There was some chatter in town for a while about the possibility of building a casino there. It's been in the news for a long time that the current administration at City Hall was trying to get permission to build a casino somewhere downtown. There were three or four different sites proposed, and the end result of it was that the whole thing was shot down. The citizens of Toronto didn't want a casino in their downtown, and so that's not what's going in at Exhibition Place. The park area behind Exhibition Place, between Exhibition Place and the lake, is called Ontario Place. That is so Exhibition Place is city-owned property. Ontario Place is province-owned property. Our province is like your state, so it's sort of the next level up of government. That's been shuttered for a year and a bit now because the province has decided that the way that it was structured was not profitable enough and they want to do something different with it. I think they've now decided that it's going to be split between condominium development and parkland. So there's going to be some stuff changing and going up in there. As far as I know at this point, Exhibition Place is not changing as a result of that. I think they're building a hotel, you and I found, mm-hmm. on one of the parking lots that's been there for years and years and years. But that's the only thing that's on the docket for that area right now, as far as I know.
Now, when we talk about Exhibition Place, is that basically everything between the Gardner Expressway, the major divided raised highway there, and Lakeshore, or is it only a small portion of that?
No, that's exactly right. And it extends a little bit out to the west of the track from where the track ends, mm-hmm. and it ends at the east at Strawn Avenue, which is the street right outside of the Prince's Gates at Turn 1.
Okay. So then the other area that you're talking about, this Ontario Place, that would be south of
Lakeshore. That's south of Lakeshore. And that's that issue that you and I have talked about so many times where you've been saying, oh, they should put a grandstand on the outside of Turn 3. And I keep telling you they can't because that's provincial land and the Exhibition Place is city land. And you have to go through scads and scads of paperwork to get the approval to do both. So
they should still put seating out there.
I know. I let me just virtually pat you on the head.
Wait a minute. I think you're pandering me.
You think?
Hey. There is seating out there now, though, we noticed. It's general admission on what I would call closer to a grassy knoll.
No,
there on the
what we discovered was that last year they had that opening as general admission, and this year they didn't. Remember, there was that one group that was sitting out having a little picnic on their blanket, and they were the only ones on the whole hill, and I'm pretty sure they were about to be removed. Mm.
I still say if you can get outside that turn, that's an even better view from...
long as they don't put up all of those banners in the way, which they did, so...
True.
There were banners all through the outside of the fencing at Turn 3.
Yeah, but you could even go on the other side of Turn 3... on the same side of Lakeshore, on the other side of, what is that, Ontario Drive, I think, that makes Turn 3 there. If you went on the west side of that, that'd be a great shot from there, too. Thinking out loud here.
Anyway. You'd have to build a bridge to do that, and bridges are expensive.
All right, I'll give you that.
Yeah. Let's talk about some other stuff. So here's a question for you. Do you think it's good or bad that NBC just signed a 10-year deal to carry the chase of from Sprint Cup?
I think it'll be good for the first couple of years. I think it really will be the whole rising tide raises all boats. I think eventually IndyCar will get shuffled down, especially if NBC really goes full bore into it, like Speed Network does, for instance, and starts having three and four different auxiliary programs per event. Then I think IndyCar really starts to struggle there. I think what IndyCar is really going to need to push, and from whatever leverage they may have, is they're going to need to hold hands with Formula One and push together and really make sure that open wheel racing in general maintains some level of respect and representation on the network.
I think otherwise, you're dreaming.
Probably. But I think if they don't find some way to go in with Formula One, because I don't think Formula One's going to be necessarily benefited in the long term from this either. I think they're going to need to push to keep an open wheel presence there, or they could get buried pretty quickly. But it will be beneficial, because this is going to really, I think, bring more viewers to the network. It's going to make just a whole lot more awareness of the NBC Sports Network. And that's still another year and a half away. I mean, NBC Sports Network is growing quickly as it is. This is only going to bolster that on top of what it's going to, that trajectory it's already on.
Well, you're slightly more optimistic than I am. I think there's a possibility that it could help IndyCar and that it could be beneficial for all motorsport. It certainly is a good thing from the consumer side to have one channel that they can subscribe to get all of their motorsport needs met, or at least for a portion of the season. But on the other hand, it could also hurt them all if not enough people decide that they're invested enough in motorsport to sign up. So could go either way. I can certainly understand the concerns that NBC Sports Network's marketing efforts toward IndyCar might be decreased somewhat, especially since they've shown a trend toward that, apparently, with the Formula One stuff this year. I don't get much from NBC Sports Network except the actual broadcasts on Sportsnet in Canada, so I'm not 100% sure on that. I mean, I just am repeating what I've heard, but the impression apparently has been that Formula One is getting more attention, and I imagine that that would be the case for NASCAR as well, and so I can understand why IndyCar fans would be somewhat concerned about that. But I think it's a tough call.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think IndyCar is getting the coverage, certainly, that Formula One is. And I think it's realistic to expect it'll go even lower when NASCAR comes on board. But just the general growth of NBC Sports Network in general is going to help IndyCar. I mean, they've already got NASCAR. They got Formula One. They're picking up the English Premier League. They're going to have another round of the Olympics next spring. Next winter, I guess it is. The 2014 Winter Olympics will be heavily rotated on NBC Sportsnet. The NHL is still there, and that's growing quickly on the network. So there's a lot more attention going to this network. It's not a network that's going to be going away, and it's only going to have more and more and more viewers coming to it over the next, I guess it's probably almost 2 years now before they really start in on their NASCAR coverage, because I don't think they start until the second half of 15. Assuming they don't do a whole blanket in the first half of the year as well. So I think it's going to help from the standpoint of just bringing more attention, more viewers, more subscribers to the network.
Well, certainly one potential side effect, positive side effect, would be that I would imagine that IndyCar would be making more of an effort to make sure that their late season dates don't conflict with chase races.
Yes.
So that their events will always be live, and that is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly less conflict there is a positive. So, Let's talk about a little fluff story boot before we get back into the serious stuff. How about Turbo? I haven't seen it yet because my daughter is very young, and I'm told that there may be some scenes that she would find slightly disturbing. I know when I saw the PG rating on the on an animated movie, I kind of went, "Ew, that's not great." But I mean, that's because I went to broadcasting school, and we were always told back then that anything but a G rating on an animated movie was suicide. But I don't know if that's still the case. That was a long time ago. No, I'm not going to tell you how long ago. You took Jackson to see it, didn't you?
I did, uh-huh. He loved it. He absolutely loved it. And I don't recall any scenes that would have been necessarily traumatic.
I remember somebody told me that some snails get eaten by birds at some point.
Oh, yeah, they kind of get plucked away. It's not like they graphically show them digesting them. Kind of get picked off, if you will.
Yeah, I think my daughter would get upset by that. She's very sweet, my daughter, and I think I would have a lot of explaining to do afterward about that sort of thing.
Where does she get that from? Either you or Jacob. I don't see.
Shut up. She's inherently sweet. Let's move on.
Yes, but the movie, it was. It could be considered a little bit cheesy. I mean, there's no real surprises
in it.
It's
a kids' movie.
It is, exactly. It is. But it's worth your money to go just to see the Indianapolis Motor Speedway represented as it is. It's almost haunting, the level of detail of the Speedway, from the stands to the facilities there to the track itself. The only thing I noticed that kind of rubbed me the wrong way was that the start-finish line didn't necessarily match up with the way it is at the track. That's the only thing in all of the entire Speedway, I think, that I noticed that wasn't really, really accurate. I mean, they had, like I said, even like where the media center is, Victory Lane, the pagoda, the start finish, the starter stand, all the grandstands. It was almost eerie how realistic it was.
Hmm. Well,
just the start finish line, it really bugged me.
Everybody on the racing side who has seen it has said that they have loved it. Their kids have loved it, and that's great. It's not driven, so that's good.
Which is a funny story, now that you mentioned that, because I took Jackson to see that on Saturday, and you would have thought it was gospel. I mean, he would have thought that's actually how the Indianapolis 500 played out this year. Sunday morning, I'm channel surfing after church, and Driven is on, of all movies, Driven's on.
How funny.
And I got in on probably the last half hour, and it was like one of those, like, you know, as seen on TV things that you just can't quite turn off in the middle of the night. You just have to watch it. And Jackson actually watched the scene and goes, "Well, that can't happen." So a snail winning the 500, totally realistic. Anything in Driven, not a chance.
That's too funny.
And I had not seen Driven in probably a dozen years, and I forgot really how bad it was.
So it wasn't that bad.
It was awful.
So that's no, but Turbo wasn't as bad as that. So that's
nothing could be that bad, right?
Right. But the thing that's giving me pause is that, yeah, it's great that all the people who are involved in racing and already love racing love this movie and think it's great. But the critical reviews haven't been excellent, and the box office opening weekend wasn't excellent, and it's definitely a point of concern right now that this thing might drop off the radar without making too much of an impact. And in fact, I think I saw somewhere that DreamWorks is taking a pretty big financial hit on this one. So,
yeah, that's, you know, you certainly don't hope that to be the case, but in some ways, I almost felt when I was leaving, and I haven't heard anyone say this, maybe it was just me and kind of being as exposed to it as we were in Toronto, it almost felt like it was an infomercial for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in a lot of ways. I don't know why it kind of rubbed me that way. I just kind of got that sense.
Did you get the feeling after seeing the movie that people would have any impetus to go and seek out the series as opposed to the Indianapolis 500?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. I didn't necessarily talk to people at the theater.
No, I mean you. I mean, as somebody who knows that the series exists, from what you remember about watching the movie, do you feel like somebody would walk out of that movie thinking, oh, I need to go seek out IndyCar, as opposed to, oh, I'm going to have to watch the Indianapolis 500. When is that? Oh, next year. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know how to answer that. To put myself in a position of somebody that doesn't already follow the league. If I was just being exposed to this and saying, what are these cars? Would I go watch it? Maybe. I don't know. That's a difficult question to answer.
Well, I'm hoping to get myself out to see this in the fairly near future. So that's some of the stuff that I will definitely be looking for. But who knows? Might not even be in the theaters by the time I get to go see it.
Stop.
Anyway, my primary concern is that it's making an impact with the people who already love racing. They weren't after us with this one. And with the people who aren't, it doesn't seem to be making really great waves. So, you know, crazy things happen. Maybe something will change. But for now, it's something that's worth keeping an eye on. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
Okay, we need to talk about this change to the engine rules for next year. Let's just sort of briefly run it down, because this was something that was just released by the time people will be listening to this yesterday. So we already know that Chevrolet is using a twin turbocharger in their engine. Apparently, somewhere along the way, Honda has either tacitly or otherwise agreed to use a twin turbo in their engine for 2014. And so IndyCar has now mandated that all engines to be in use for 2014 will be twin turbocharged engines. Do you want to go first on this one? Or do you want me to go first? Because I'm going to fire with both barrels a little bit.
Okay, I'll go first then.
Okay.
First of all, this really came out of nowhere for me. Maybe I've been unplugged a little bit the last couple of weeks, but I mean, this was one of those emails I got today when they released a statement that just had me scratching my head as to, where did this come from? It just seemed completely out of left field, particularly that Honda seems to really have made some progress lately with their single turbo. And they say they wanted more parity with it. And I got thinking, okay, well, both of them have won on technical street courses. Both of them have won on big ovals this year. You know, we've had 13 races. Chevrolet's won 7 and Honda's won 6. I mean, how much more parity is it that they're looking for? So the longer I started thinking about it, then I can see where some of these issues are difficult for them to deal with. And I think we've seen really what's happened in Indianapolis the last couple of years could be a result of this. When IndyCar goes to change boost levels, I think it's very difficult to equilibrate the performance of the single.
Equilibrate?
That's a word.
That's an awesome word if it is one. Sorry, but carry on.
That is a word. Yes, equilibrate, to make equal the difference in performance of a twin turbo versus a single turbo when you're changed at different boost levels. So, I mean, IndyCar, is it 130, I think, is what the standard oval is, and then the push-to-pass goes to one. Do they have push-to-pass? I forget what they do on ovals. But the qualifying then at Indianapolis is at 140. The standard road and street course, I think, is 140, and then the push to pass goes to 150, or it's at 150 and goes to 160. I forget which those are, but there's such a range of what these boost levels are that I can see where it's difficult to make sure the performance is equal. And IndyCar, from the beginning, since 2012 started, their stated goal is that while we want the turbos, we don't want the different turbo architectures to necessarily affect the power. Yeah, there's an inherent performance difference between a single and dual, and that should be somewhat accounted for. But that whole thing of going through TurboGate last year was to make the performance of the turbocharger as equal as possible. What your engine does with that turbo is open game, but the performance of the turbo itself should be equal. So that was my first reaction, and when I got thinking about it. On the flip side of that, there was a lot of disappointment from the tightening of the specs again. When IndyCar first announced these engine rules back in 2010 during the whole iconic committee issue, originally it was either 2.4 or 2.6. I think it was 2.6 liter engines, maximum of 6 cylinders, could be turbo, could be single turbo, could be dual turbo, could be normally aspirated, could be a V6, could be an inline 4. Everything was open. And then we said, okay, now it has to be a V6 turbo. We can still do single or we can do dual. And now we're down to only a V6 twin turbo engine with no other architectures available, which I think there was a hope all along, particularly early, that if you allowed some of the smaller displacement inline fours with bigger turbos, that would bring in more manufacturers, whether that's Audi, whether it's Volkswagen, whether it's Alfa, Ford maybe, whatever that is. I think this starts to shut some of them off. The longer I got thinking about that, well, a lot of the people, it's interesting because a lot of the people that decry IndyCar for being a spec series, and that seems to be what a lot of people are reacting to this. They're saying, oh, this is just another step for IndyCar becoming a spec series. And then they point back to CART, say, look at this great competition we had. We had two tire manufacturers and three engine manufacturers, or four engine manufacturers and three or four different chassis manufacturers. But what was the constant in that? From 1978 to 2007, CART/Champ Car always only had a 2.65 liter turbocharged engine, V8. There wasn't a variety of architecture there, and things went just fine with that single engine architecture. So I guess in my long roundabout way of saying is my initial response was not very positive, but in the end, I don't think it really makes that much difference.
There were a lot of things that could be talked about, though, around that 2.65 liter V8 engine that made things different enough to keep people talking. The only thing that IndyCar has right now to differentiate really between the Honda and the Chevrolet, other than the badge on the side of the car, is the fact that Honda uses a single and Chevy uses a double. Now, if Honda made the decision on their own to go to a twin, great, let them, no problem. If you want to completely, you know, redesign your engine around a twin turbo because you think you're going to get better performance out of it, go to. But why legislate it? What if somebody else wants to come in next year with a single? You're not going to tell them no? Why would you do that? And why would you take the one story, the one technical story that you have week in and week out that people can relate to and can follow and take it away? It makes absolutely no sense. Why would you, in a time when people are screaming for some sort of innovation, some sort of sign that IndyCar is seeking to encourage innovation and not be a spec series, would you take a step toward, visually toward, becoming more of a spec series? It makes no sense at all. It's such bad optics, and I was very frustrated by it.
Were those rhetorical questions?
You want to take a shot? Go for it.
I just don't see a large percentage, and by large percentage, I mean probably 5%. I don't see more than that number of people really delving into it that deep, of the people that are really that are watching the races.
No, I mean, but that's the thing. That's the thing about this is that it's even people who don't know a lot about cars can say, oh, Honda has a single turbo and Chevy has a twin turbo, and Honda's better on long straights because once they spool up, they're faster, and Chevrolet is better on road and street courses with a lot of corners because I'm totally losing my terminology here, but that's something that is at a very basic level, easy to relate to technically, And people enjoy following that and enjoy being able to feel like they know enough about what's going on to talk about it. And I think once you've got very little that's different other than the name on the side of the car, and you're bringing those differences, you're creating a more narrow field for those differences to be spotted. I mean, why not just, somebody said today, made a point, why not just, you know, say somebody at IndyCar could go, you know what we really need is to just not have the two different names because it's too confusing. Why don't we just have one engine manufacturer and then there won't be, like, it, that sort of seems to be where they're headed with this. Why increase parity when parity is the last thing the people at home want?
I think there's still enough variety in the engine themselves. You know, just because, you know, Chevrolet in 1992 had the Chevrolet Indy V8, well, let's not talk about the B, we'll talk about the good engine, the A. Ford Cosworth came out with their XB engine that was a 2.65 liter V8 turbocharged. Same engine architecture, vastly different engines.
But I just don't.
And then Toyota.
Like, we're not even seeing engines being particularly taxed right now anyway. You see engines pop every once in a while, but certainly not at the level that they once did way, way back in the day. The revs are limited at a point where, you know, they're not really being pushed. The specs are relevant to the manufacturers, but they don't really speak to people watching at home who want to see, you know, powerful beasts with 900 horsepower, and that's not at all what they're getting. And now you're taking away another thing for that people can relate to in terms of the power generation for these cars. I spend a lot of time talking about how what people really need to be able to relate to in this series to get invested in it and follow it is the people stories, you know, the drivers and why they should be rooted for and that sort of thing. But taking away one of the simpler aspects of the car design that people can understand just makes no sense to me. Like, why legislate it? Why not leave it open? If nobody takes them up on it, fine, but why put the hammer down?
I think they put the hammer down, A, because I don't think they're expecting anyone else to come in the next couple of years.
So what?
And B, I think they want to get rid of the headache of the turbo performance difference across the different boost levels.
It's a poor excuse to me. I don't see that as being, like, if the headache's going to go away anyway, I've seen people say, well, Honda was going to do this anyway, then you're not going to have the headache anyway. So why, like, if you're not expecting anybody to come and Honda's going to switch to a twin turbo regardless, why make it a rule? And piss everybody off.
Why did they make it a rule that they couldn't make an inline four? I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
It just doesn't make any sense to me. Anyway, that's my rant. I think it was not necessary. But
it was a surprising move. Yeah, it was a surprising move. Yeah. I did not. Not only did I didn't not see it coming, I didn't have any indication that it was even something that was being considered.
Anyway, we've talked enough, I think. Let's just sort of quickly go through some of the things that we'll be watching going into Mid-Ohio. So we're going to talk a lot more about Mid-Ohio next week, but there are a couple of things that are worth bringing up just a little bit ahead of time. We found out today that here's a name we haven't heard in a while. James Davison is going to be driving the number 18 at Mid-Ohio. And that's very interesting because if it's not going to be Mike Conway, why is that the case? And there could be a couple of reasons why that might not be the case. We've all heard the rumor, I think, by now that Alex Tagliani is apparently on the rocks at BHA. And you
know, which is surprising that Davison didn't end up on that ride, given his history with Brian Herta Autosport.
Yeah, maybe it might have to do with how much money each person has to bring, which is another interesting point that came into my mind when I heard that Alex Taliani is on the rocks, because I thought to myself, gee, that's going to be a really complicated situation for them, because a good amount of the money that's running that car is Alex's personal sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly how much of it is team money and exactly how much of it is his money, but it's not a small amount that's his money. So whoever's coming has to have at least, you know, a somewhat robust checkbook, and the team's going to have a pretty big paint job on their hands, but I mean, they all do, I guess. Every week it friggin' changes on half these cars. So
is Barracuda a Tagliani sponsor?
I don't think so. I think Barracuda is a BHA.
They're with the team, yeah. Uh-huh.
But they're one of the few, I think. A lot of the stickers that you see on that car are Tag's personal sponsors. So
most prominently, the Bowers and Wilkins.
Yeah. So it shall be interesting to see if that happens, and if it does, who ends up in that ride. With Mike Conway being obviously a possibility. We've also got Oriol Servia, who's still kicking around in the mix, but one name that's been connected with it as well is J.R. Hildebrand, who is still looking for his shot, his way back in, and he's got personal sponsors that we know about, so that's a possibility. Another person we're asking questions about is Ryan Briscoe, who's theoretically meant to be in race shape by Mid-Ohio, but don't believe he's actually had the A-OK from the doctors on that yet. So will he be? And if he's not, who will be in that car? That remains to be seen. Those are all stories that we'll be following heading into that, into the Mid-Ohio weekend. One quick point for people who will be attending Mid-Ohio. Anybody who is holding a ticket for the Mid-Ohio race weekend is welcome to attend the full Wednesday test, the full day of testing at Mid-Ohio for free on next Wednesday. Why they're not letting anybody in for free on Wednesday is beyond me, but if you have a ticket, then you can go. And if you don't have a ticket, you can pay to get in. So for what it's worth, if you happen to be in Mansfield, Ohio on a Wednesday, then certainly feel free to stop by. And I guess with that, unless there's anything glaring that I've missed that you can think of, Paul.
Nope.
Great. And I guess we'll call it a day. And, we will be back next week to preview. We'll probably go over whatever we saw coming out of the Wednesday test, and then preview the weekend's coverage coming up at Mid-Ohio. So with that, in the meantime, if you need IndyCar news and views, get a grip with More Front Wing.